Secondly, the IRA, as originally applied to Alaska, included a separate reservation establishment provision. And interestingly enough, that provision was still on the books for 5 years after the Claims Act, but it was, perhaps incidentally, repealed in 1976 with the Federal Land Policy and Management Act, along with a whole bunch of other land withdrawal legislation. So you have that sort of pattern. You have the Claims Act, you have the subsequent repealed reservation authority under the IRA in Alaska, but you have the continuing reservation trust land authority under the IRA, and that's all still applicable.
So if we follow up Ralph Johnson the other day, there is a basis to make a rather large change, which is in fact just a series of small changes. It is conceivable that villages could be the possessors of the land, they could reestablish reservations, and that they could in some fashion have that land in trust. It may need not be in the Secretary, it may be under the Non-Intercourse Act even, but it's conceivable.
Oh yes, right. I mean, and, you know, can, you can sort of talk about it. We can spin this fine little or less fine little web of legal legalese here. But yeah, right. There's some. I mean, there's a statutory IRA that could do it, and even the fact that the tribe owns the land and has the title to the land would be sufficient under the Non-Intercourse Act. Although the Interior Department says the Non-Intercourse Act doesn't apply to ANCSA lands. Or finally, you get to the point of sovereign immunity. Mm-hmm. And if the tribe owns the land, then the IRA says that the tribe will cannot be dispossessed of the land without its consent. And so that, if there is there is inherent sovereign immunity in the first place, and the IRA puts a statutory confirmation on that. So, I mean, you have several levels and sort of backup positions that, in my mind, just seem to arise with the interaction of this federal legislation and the basic doctrines of Indian law.
Mr. Lerner, just before I call on you, the discussion has been wide-ranging from cosmic considerations to very specific considerations, and I think that enhances the discussion. I wonder if all of those who are legally trained around the table, for the sake of the record of this proceeding, because a typist will take the audio and type it up, I wonder if, when you have a moment this morning, you just write out on a piece of paper the names of the cases you cited that you can remember, and we can just hand the list to the typist so that she will be able to reproduce those case names without embarrassment. If I may put it in that way. The other, perhaps I just might add something that that bears on what will be happening next week at these meetings. One of the members of the media handed me a note. As you know, in Canada this week, the Prime Minister and the Premiers of the provinces are holding a constitutionally mandated meeting with the Native leaders of Canada. And that meeting is held in public and is televised to the whole nation. And I'm told that Prime Minister Trudeau yesterday proposed an amendment to the Constitution of Canada to entrench Aboriginal rights, including provisions for Native self-government, Native languages, and Native education rights. To have a constitutional amendment accepted in Canada, 7 out of 10 provinces must agree, and of the 7 provinces, one or other must be Ontario or Quebec. Those are 2 very large provinces, each with a third of the population of the country. And according to this note, Ontario, which is one of the provinces whose agreement is essential, and New Brunswick and Nova Scotia supported the proposal. 7 others argued against it and said they were opposed to it. That's an interesting development because in 1969, Prime Minister Trudeau, in a famous public statement made it clear that he would never recognize Aboriginal rights, that the rights of the Native peoples of Canada were to be regarded as no different from the rights of other Canadians, and that their claims, as he put it, could only be satisfied as citizens of Canada in the same way that the claims of other citizens of Canada to education, health, housing, and a good life could be achieved. I suppose this illustrates that much is happening in other places besides Alaska, and when the Canadian Native leaders arrive here next week, it will be very interesting to see how that proposal was greeted. It says here that one of the Native leaders said it was a grand gesture. Well, no doubt it was. And I say this about next week, that we will start on, we won't start on Tuesday morning, but we will start Tuesday afternoon at 1:15. That's when the third and last session of the overview will be completed, Tuesday at 1:15, and apart from David Case and Rosita Worrell and myself, who it is to be hoped that we provide some continuity from one session to the next, Browning Pipestem will be here from the Lower 48, and I hope one or two others who will introduce an Alaskan flavor to the proceedings. I think that Mr. Lerner, you were next on my list. Interesting.
I had a question from Mr. Case, but the briefest comment on your observation about Mr. Trudeau. Either he has reached a different understanding of the matter, or he is acting on his publicly proclaimed decision not to seek elective office again in Canada.
Or both,
right. I think that will be probably an exhaustive classification. Mr. Case, if I heard you correctly, you were saying that an IRA government could not be deprived of its lands without its consent. If that's if the language has that kind of definiteness, that would be a greater protection than
We wanted federal protection, not federal domination. And of course, this is open to interpretations, but that was the most concise phrase that we could come up with as we worked to redefine our relationship with the federal government. Here in Alaska, the Native peoples have a high degree of political power and economic power. And I feel that this needs to really be analyzed, explored, and utilized. Politicians respond to pressure. And with the upcoming elections that are coming soon, the Native peoples need to develop their particular platform, whatever it is, and confront the congressperson, I know you have one, the two senators, and other people that are involved in the political process, and to utilize the voting power and other political and economic power that is available under this system of government. If a small tribe like the Menominees can achieve what we did in the time that we did it with very little money and with excellent legal assistance, and we don't have the percentage of people in our state as as you all do here, you know, you can do, you know, what you want to do. Of course, you have to figure out what you want to do, and I feel that it's clear that people do want to maintain the land, they want to maintain the resources. I think people here have been very eloquent in expressing what the aspirations are. Now, there may be different ways in achieving this, but again, I look at 1991 as this huge pressure coming down, and that people do have to get mobilized. I also want to make a slight correction in my comments about the churches. And I would like all people, church members, natives, and others, to really think through what the role of the churches has been in Indian affairs. I know that people in the churches were very involved in the Dawes Act, for example. And a good example of the participation of churches today is the Friends Committee on National Legislation. It's a very small group in Washington, D.C. that listens to what Indian people want and then does it. And I would like to suggest that it's time for all the churches to examine what their roles are, what their functions are, what their responsibilities are, and that they need to be more responsive and responsible in their actions in this area of social action and political activity.
Thank you. Russell Jim.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I too would like to express the gratitude with the eloquence of which Mr. Katzenstag brought forth in regard to the importance and the very crux of this whole forum is the culture of the people. And I keep hearing these overtones that continues to confirm that perhaps the first treaty did have at the bottom.
There were parts where we should get together ourselves. And maybe Fergus little farms to help run things like that, so that the governments of each country could hear about the people that he took their land away from. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Starr. I think you've given us all food for thought from experience that goes back longer than that of any of us by a long shot. Mr. Katzenstag.
Yes, first of all, Mr. Commissioner, I would like to thank you for showing the respect for an elder in our presence by allowing him to speak. Second of all, I have seen it written, and I believe that it is true, that all honest men belong to one tribe. And that is one of the bases why we as Native people are now in the position that we are, fighting from a defensive. In relating with the United States government, we did it in good faith. We believed that they, like we, we're looking out for our mutual best interests. The United States has made great progress as far as freedom is concerned. We are one of the freest nations in the world. I have traveled, not extensively, but I have traveled some abroad. And believe me, it's always great to come back home. Along that same line, I believe that we, the Native people, especially of Alaska, this being the so-called last frontier of North America, are the freest people in North America. And since the United States government and its people places so much lip service in support of freedom and democracy, I would think that if they were looking out for our best interests, as we, the freest people, that they would do everything in their power to ensure that we as a culture and a people survive. Our people are very, very independent. That is one of the things that, one of the aspects of our people which Western society is not very well aware. In a matter of hours, we can be sitting here talking in this great urban mass of civilization, and to us it's a jungle. We have more problems trying to keep our personal bodies all in one piece and safe here in a civilized area than we do back in the village. And when we get out into the country, which we are so much a part of,
so bring in a new perspective that those foundations maybe possibly could be changed, and that it would not necessarily be the federal government in the trust situation with IRA governments. It's a different situation, and I think that needs to be emphasized, as apart from what has happened in the 48, that the IRA situation, which you have in mind, is a much different vision or view than what has happened in the lower 48.
Yes, Mr. Ketchetag.
One last point in this regard is that the Secretary of the Interior, through the IRA Act of 1934, was authorized at his discretion to set up reservations. And there has only been one reservation set up in the whole state of Alaska, the Metlakatla. Now, I really don't see that if we are to be truly self-determining, to be truly self-sufficient, that we are to rely on the discretion of one man, any one man. And again, it brings my point about us being able to hold land in trust as governments. Whether or not it's IRA or not, we still have tribal government. Congress could go ahead and say tomorrow that by an act of Congress, there shall be no more IRAs, period. But that would still not do anything about tribal governments. We would change our hats again. And land to the natives up here in Alaska, we believe that land is not something that you own. Land is something that you use, take care of, interact with, and harmonize with. And it is to be respected as such, because it provides anything and everything for us that we live on. It's only since our interaction with the Western society that we have even thought of owning land. But if in fact that is the only way that the Western society understands land and its use, then we are going to adapt to that also. And please don't be ever mistaken to think that the Native people of Alaska are going to abide by the Claim Settlement Act boundaries. We were not raised that way, and we don't raise our children that way. Our land boundaries are very ancient, and I see a movement afoot now for the Native peoples to start saying, okay, since the Western society does not abide by or even recognize oral, unwritten boundaries, and by golly, we're going to put them down so that you do recognize them. And we may not ever get title to them, but we still believe that we exert jurisdiction over them. And I will always make the point that political power is always at the goodwill of the people. And if they say, and by they I mean the tribal members, if they say that that is the direction that they want their leaders to go, then they better go that way. Thank you.
I think I should say that this morning, Mr. Khachatag, you said that you said that political power comes from the people. There was a discussion, a very lengthy discussion, throughout this week, turning on that very question, and people around the table, and some who are now gone, back to the Lower 48, discussed the question, where does sovereignty come from? And I won't say that there was unanimity on the point, but the same question that you asked was asked here, and a number of answers offered. Joe Jorgensen, and then David Case.
Pardon the redundancy, but I did want to respond to Mr. Khachatag's point about where trust responsibility sits. 2 days ago, I mentioned the Western Shoshone case. I want to bring it up one more time. The Western Shoshone had ceded to them about 15 million acres in western Utah and Nevada. They seek the return of that land, and they have asserted ownership over it for many, many years. They have continued to hunt on land that is either federal or state land and gone to court over it. They continue to run their cattle on federal or state lands without paying fees on it and have been taken to court over that. And now they seek, and on March 11th they will meet with the Senate Select Committee, as well as with their own leadership and with their attorneys and with the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in an attempt to do several things, one of which is to gain title to that land and that it not be conveyable, and that the protection for them come under the Indian Non-Intercourse Act. There's no mention of trusteeship vested in the Secretary of the Interior or in the federal government, but there is protection through the Indian Non-Intercourse Act. It might be instructive and worthwhile to watch what happens in these negotiations that are going on now, and they may have some application, although the case is very different from the Alaska situation, they may have some application down the road for Alaska Natives.
David Case.
Yeah, I have a...
in that process, but let's take a tribe, some of those that at one time or another accepted the IRA and accepted the Secretary of Interior's authority to approve amendments to the tribal code or the tribal constitution. What's happened in recent years, and as I say, it's not a widely known thing, it isn't published widely, but what privately is happening is that a tribe goes to the Secretary of the Interior and says, we want to change our constitution so that you don't have any authority to refuse to approve our code or changes in our code. And he says, I won't do that. And then we say, and then the tribe says, we're going to do it anyway. And when it comes to the crunch, and when the pressure's on, the Secretary of the Interior can insist upon veto power or some control under one circumstance very clearly, and that is when trust property is involved. He refuses to relinquish that at all because he has a legal obligation to approve any action that would have to do with trust property or water rights, including water rights. The other area where the Secretary of the Interior has been particularly hard to deal with on this issue is when the Indian Civil Rights Act questions, due process questions are involved. He feels that he should exercise some review powers there. But aside from those two areas, there are all kinds of other activities that the tribe engages in, enacting laws or whatever, that is really not the Secretary's business. And when the tribe pushes very hard, the Secretary says, okay, then I won't insist upon my right of approval of that. Now, but realize that it sometimes the tribes view it in their own interest to get that approval, because if they wish to apply that ordinance to non-Indians on the reservation, for example, and you're going to have that challenge in a federal court, it sometimes is very influential to say, well, this was approved by the Secretary of the Interior, and so it has the stamp of the federal government on it. So it's not always a question of the tribe saying, we don't want your approval. They may very well want that approval. But it's a different question then. It may be a question of the tribe feeling that it can enhance its position now by getting the approval, not that it has to have it in order for the document or the law or the regulation to become effective. The regulation or the law would become effective then not because of the federal governmental structure under the IRA, but because of the inherent sovereignty of the tribe. And just because the tribe has organized under the IRA does not mean that the inherent sovereignty is now gone. It's still there. At least that's our argument. It's still there. There's just simply an organization here that's an IRA organization, but it leaves this other power, this latent power of the people that Mr. Kutztag, that still is there. Nothing happened to it.
I wonder, what I was going to suggest now, if you will allow me to do so, is that in a moment we break for a cup of coffee for 5 minutes, and then we'll ask Ralph
in some distant future. Then you've got to preserve some flexibility. Who can answer that for you?
Ada Deer?
I appreciate very much the honor and the pleasure of being invited to participate in this Alaska Native Review Commission session. It's been a tremendous and exciting experience participating in this high-speed seminar with the minds of Professor Johnson and other professors here and the Native peoples. I've learned a lot and am heartened by what I've heard. People of goodwill, scholars, and others who are new to Alaska and new to the area of Indian affairs have asked extremely penetrating questions of moral nature, intellectual nature, a political nature, a cultural nature, a legal nature. And there are no easy answers to any of these. I'm reminded of what one author said, we not only react to our environment, we in a large measure can create our environment. And I think that this is what is in process here. There's much I could say, but I would ask all of us, natives and others alike, to seize this moment in history and do it right. When we were working on our Menominee restoration, Senator Ted Kennedy came and spoke to one of our meetings, and he said, in reviewing the history of American Indian affairs, there's very little that we can be proud of. But he commended the Menominee people and all others who were working at that time. And I do want to pay recognition to the many who did help us in our effort. We didn't do it alone. He did want to state that the Menominee restoration would be an exception to this, that this would be an example of the American system working to bring about justice. And with the intelligence, the imagination, the dedication, and the commitment that we've heard here, we have an